From listener-supported KTOO, welcome to A Juno Afternoon. It's Wednesday, May 23rd, 2023. I'm your host, Boston Christopher Gunathjeeshawa, for joining the conversation. On today's show, the Juno Symphony closes out their season with showdowns, including a collaboration with musicians Taylor Vidic and Spencer Edgers. Sentinel Island Lighthouse Cruise is happening soon. There is a new augmented reality tour over at Treadwell Historic Trail. We'll talk about the tech and more. And the Juno Public Library has some updates, including an upcoming author event with Zeta Elliott. Those conversations, Bird Note, Sounds Wild, music and more, coming up right here on A Juno Afternoon.
Hanson Gress. Ka eat with the shu yi, we kashuk a yi tin. Jin kat ka ke jin tau kanakaya ha ane kak. Gunnish cheese.
Quick programming note before we start today. Juno Afternoon will be on break from tomorrow, Thursday, May 25th, through Tuesday, June 6th. If you are looking to get on the program in June, email junoafternoon@ktoo.org, and we will get back to you in early June when we return. Gunathjeeshawa for your continued support of Juno Afternoon.
He speaks so. Knows where each word's bound to go. He walks in a steady line, moves the way he's moved 100 times before. Simply practice before. He knew that he'd be mine. Whisper me words that I don't know I need to hear. No, I don't need them. Oh, but I want them. Show me the sides that I don't know.
You're listening to community-supported Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno and 91.7 Juno Auk Bay and online at ktoo.org. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. The Juno Symphony closes out its 60th anniversary season next weekend, June 3rd and 4th, with showdowns. Epic music from Lord of the Rings, Batman, Star Trek, and more, as well as epic and awesome collaboration with musicians Taylor Vidic and Spencer Edgers. They, along with Christopher Cook, music director for the symphony, join me in the studio now. Welcome all to you. Gunathjeesh for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Yes,
hello. Absolutely. Hello, hello. So let's get right to this collaboration. I know there's more to this concert, but you're here in the studio, and that's what we're going to mainly focus on, is talking about this collaboration. We heard a little bit of your song coming in here, Taylor, Cat and Mouse, mm-hmm. in the intro, but it's going to sound a bit different come June 3rd and 4th. I'm wondering, what is this collaboration and how did it come about?
Oh, Christopher, you want to start? Maybe I'll, okay, I feel like there are many layers
There's
to this
layers
story.
Layers.
Chapter one.
Yeah. Well, I was at Foodland and see, nope.
Okay. I met Spencer when I was living in Seattle in 2018. We worked for a boating company and we played some music together then and then continued to be friends. And I found various ways to bring him up to Southeast Alaska to play with the Nude and Rude Review and an old band of mine, Airport Strangers. So we've been collaborating for the last couple of years. And Spencer conveniently went to school for music composition. You have a master's in music composition?
Yes, in film scoring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I met Christopher last summer. And Christopher, I'm so excited that Christopher moved to this town and has brought a new idea of what orchestras and symphonies can look like and the kind of music that we can do and where it can be played. So we've gotten to collaborate a couple of times on various events And Christopher said, hey, what if we featured one of your songs? And I was like, well, conveniently, I know a guy who I think could orchestrate one of my songs and whom I would really trust to and would be honored to get to work with in this really big, cool, meaningful way. And the Juno Symphony said yes and continued to usher the idea along. And so it's my song orchestrated by Spencer, thanks to help of and instrumentation by the Juno Symphony.
That's awesome. So Spencer, what's it like composing or arranging a song like this and putting it in orchestral form?
It's a really interesting process because, I mean, this song, when Taylor plays it solo or with a band, it's really just centered around the strumming of her acoustic guitar. And so kind of taking that pretty simple, repetitive, rhythmic figure and then putting it everywhere in the orchestra and putting all sorts of layers around it and sort of expanding on it. It's a really interesting process. And I think it ended up being, you know, you kind of take it and run with it. And it ended up being, you know, taking on almost a whole different form. And I think the first time I played what I had for Taylor, she was like, that was not what I was expecting, but I like it a lot.
Because there's just so many more instruments, right? And I mean, you using winds and brass and all, I don't know all the different things from the symphony, but you're using all those things, right?
Yep, absolutely. You've got your winds, brass, woodwinds more specifically. Then you've got your whole giant string section,
right?
As well as percussion and one of my favorite instruments, harp and piano.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Just casually throw a harp in there.
Yeah. Why not?
You've got it. Use it.
Might as well use it. And because I know, I think I've seen this song live, and I know in the piece we were just playing, I think there's a little bit of a saxophone, and then there's, of course, Kelsey playing the, how do you say it? It's the cajon.
Yeah.
Yeah, the cajon. And that's it. You and the cajon, a sax and a guitar and your voice.
Uh-huh.
And so what's it like for you, Taylor, to go to rehearsal or hear this thing and be like, wow, you well up in that moment?
Yeah.
Like, does your heart fill and be like, wow, this is like, does it make you think about music in a different way? Like, what does it do to you?
That's a good question. My friend, Stephen Young, who plays tuba in the symphony, sent me a little clip of the song last night. It was the first time that any portion of the symphony had gathered to play through it.
Yeah.
And even just this 15-second clip of a handful of instruments, more or less just honking a part of the song, because I didn't have to. I got to write a bio for the symphony program.
Yes.
And I sent that in, and bless Charlotte Truitt. She was like, this is really great.
Start with a compliment, and then.
So sweet that you just want to thank so many people.
Yeah.
But what I need from you is why people are listening to you and how you got here. Mm. And I was like, but I am so overwhelmed by, like, why I am here is because of so many people saying yes to me and giving me opportunity.
Yeah.
And so my bio really does just feel like a grouping of thanks that I need to and want to give.
Mm.
And so it will be fascinating to be at the concert next weekend and not allow myself to become so overwhelmed by it that I cannot perform adequately.
Right. Because you're doing an additional song, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We also, so Spencer also, added, how would you say, we're doing a song from Waitress, the musical.
Right. Okay.
Written by Sarah Bareilles, Used to Be Mine. And Spencer also orchestrated, that song. So yeah, I'll be doing, two songs that night, both orchestrated by Spencer.
Spencer, I know this is an impossible question to answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How do you do it?
I would say, you know, a lot of it is relying on instinct and having listened to lots and lots of music, and, you know, listening to orchestral music. I think I was lucky enough. My parents took me to my first Seattle Symphony concert when I was probably like 4 or 5 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, just school and training and learning how learning how all the different instruments work, because that's a really important part, and how they blend together as well, how they, you know, they all have strengths and weaknesses, and making them all come together to achieve one goal is a really interesting process.
Did you study classical music?
No, I have a kind of unique background in that way, where besides my early piano lessons when I was a kid, I didn't really have classical training, and I'm a saxophonist as well. That's my main instrument, and I was kind of brought up through the jazz world, through the Black American music world, and then went from that to having a real interest in scoring films and writing music for video games, stuff like that. And then went on to study film scoring. And so my orchestration knowledge is kind of rooted in that world.
It's interesting, because I know that, like, you talk about video games and movies, and I think they always say that that's what the sort of composers of yesteryear, you know, were in a sense doing. And now the composers that are studying that kind of music are doing that. Are doing film soundtracks, right? That's where that money is for composers these days. So it's a really interesting thing. But to be taking, like, you know, sort of folk music or these other, like a musical, and sort of orchestrating that's really interesting. And it's like a process of, you know, is it late night? Is that what you do? Would you wake up at 3 and go, I got it?
That does happen sometimes, yeah.
Like, more cowbell.
Yeah. Just be laying in bed.
Yeah.
Needs more cowbell.
Yeah, needs more cowbell.
That's the final finishing touch.
Wow. Okay, so Christopher, why Taylor? Why now? What is this about in terms of this collaboration? Is it a commitment to some of the local musicians that we have here? I mean, I know the symphony does that anyway with all the members of the symphony, but
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And, you know, just in the way that we've been, you know, some of our Juno Symphony radio shows this season, of course, we like to talk about orchestral music, but we also like to talk about our musical community here, mm-hmm. and to feature musicians such as Taylor. And as Taylor said, we met last summer when we moved here. And as I said at the first radio interview we ever had, Taylor helped us find a short-term rental, which was greatly appreciated, because we had a long odyssey between moving to Juno and having a place to live in Juno.
See. This is payback.
It's payback. You know it.
Adequate payback.
But, you know, we just got to talking about music and about ideas, and we were formulating. So this is our 60th anniversary season. Yeah. So the idea of the season was to sort of bring everything to the table. And that's why we call it our epic season. Every single event has been a little bit above and beyond. Big mm-hmm. rep, big things. And so when we were thinking about our final concert, so Showdowns, the idea really, yes, in a sense, true Showdowns, and we're featuring Showdowns, you know, like Gondor versus Mordor and Kirk versus Khan, things like that. But it's really more the idea of Showdowns, because our lives are filled with them, internal, external. Sometimes there's nothing better than a good face-off, and sometimes face-offs are challenging. So it's really, you know, it's an interesting concept that sort of shows titans going one up one against one another, I guess you could say.
Nice.
And so, you know, part of this sort of percolated through Taylor shared some of her music, and I couldn't help notice the title of one of them, Cat and Mouse, which of course is one of the most epic showdowns ever. And just along the way.
Wait, I just want to say, I'm watching Taylor's face as she realizes that is an epic showdown between the cat and the mouse. She just was like, she just did that face.
I'm over here singing a love song, but no, it's as simple as the title. God damn.
But it's also amazing, because when you think of a cat and a mouse, you know, there is that primal biological showdown between two creatures. But we use that expression to mean so many different things, and it has so many layers of meaning, as the love song does.
Yeah.
So
love songs are often epic showdowns.
They are, you know, and often between a person and their own emotional state. I mean, so it's a fascinating thing. And anyway, I just thought out loud to myself, well, wouldn't it be great to have I don't know. Let's have something different on the concert. That's, what if Taylor sang on the concert?
Yeah, it's awesome. So you got anything from Scott Pilgrim versus the World?
Ooh.
Wow.
Sex Ba-Bomb. You know, that was actually Beck.
Oh, interesting.
Which I finally figured out that I figured that out a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
But yes, I would love to have Scott Pilgrim.
When I think of Epic Showdowns, I definitely think of that movie just because of all the things that are in it. So I know you mentioned a couple of things. Is there anything else that you want to highlight that we'll be hearing at this concert? And this concert's next weekend. It's not this weekend. It's next weekend, June 3rd and 4th.
June 3rd and 4th.
Yeah.
It really is the culmination of a celebratory season for us. So we're pulling out the stops with some music from familiar sources, but some of it is music that you don't often get to hear outside of the movies. So we're excited about that. In addition to Taylor and Spencer, we'll also have Sarah Radke Brown joining us, and she will be singing Twilight and Shadow from Lord of the Rings, which is a beautiful moment from the film. And then, of course, all of our wonderful musicians.
That's awesome. And are you going to be, or have you already announced the 61st season, or is that happening at this event or no?
We won't make a formal announcement until probably midsummer about the next season.
I see.
But one thing that is out there that we're it's already being talked about, and it's gonna be in the program. We are collaborating with Juno Lyric Opera to bring Leonard Bernstein's Candide to Juno next October 21st and 22nd. So we're very excited about that, and that will be part of our next season.
That's awesome. This concert sounds pretty amazing. So give us the details, the when, the where, the how.
So June 3rd and 4th, on June 3rd, Saturday at 8 p.m. On June 4th, Sunday at 3 p.m., both in Juno Douglas High School. And you can find more information and ticketing information at junosymphony.org.
That's awesome. Well, Gwyneth Cheese, for you all being here today, I'm so excited to hear this collaboration between Spencer and Taylor, and with the Juno Symphony and Christopher Cook sort of making that happen and having that awesome background of all our local musicians in the symphony. And Sarah Radke Brown will be there as well. That's the junosymphony.org for all the information goodness on this upcoming final concert of the 60th season, including some of your favorite epic movie soundtracks and this awesome collaboration with Taylor Vidic and Spencer Edgars. Thank you all for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
On my ears, baby, put your hands in mine, and I'll sing softly. Sing softly, my body right. Tingled in telephone lines, whisper me words that I don't know I need to hear. No, I don't need them. Oh, but I want them. Show me the sign.
KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Akwan. The Glenadie have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot, once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages, and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life. For today, and for future generations. This is Juno Afternoon from your listener-supported public media station, KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. Renee Hughes is here in the studio to share the details on the Sentinel Island Lighthouse Cruise that's coming and to get our taste buds jazzed up for the famous picnic that she does. Gonna the cheese for being here, Renee.
Oh, thank you very much.
And you brought Gary along here as well. He may or may not speak. It's all good. Nice to see you both. It's such a pleasure to have you here. So first of all, tell us about this amazing lighthouse. Where is it? And for the people who don't know.
Well, Sentinel Island is just off the shore of, you can see it from Eagle Beach, and it's right next to Benjamin Island. And most people that are going by on ferry, you know, pass it about 45 minutes out of the ferry terminal.
Oh, okay. And so you might have seen it on your way in or out of the ferry terminal. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And we've been running the lighthouse for 25 years now, and we're looking forward to celebrate.
Wow. That's pretty awesome. So what is the cruise?
We've partnered up with Juno Lighthouse Tours, and they are going to take us out there. We're going to go by Benjamin Island, and we built a new float out there, and so the boat will be able to dock and we'll be able to go onto the island a lot easier than it used to be. And then we're going to go on shore. Gary will probably do a little history of lighthouses and talk about the island and some of the things that the Historic Society has been doing for the past 25 years. And we'll have a great lunch, picnic. You know, hopefully the weather's going to be just like yesterday.
Let's hope, always. I have a secret love for lighthouses. So these things are, so they're so fascinating, right? There's something about them. It's like moth to the flame kind of in a way, you know, because they're just big giant thing and a light comes out of it. And you're like, I want to go to that. I want to see how it's built. I love going up in them. I love the lenses of them, all that kind of stuff. Now, this cruise is a fundraiser for the Last Chance Mining Museum, right? And can you tell us a little bit about the Last Chance Mining Museum?
Well, the lighthouses and the mining museum kind of complement each other because lighthouses were built because of the gold rush era. And the mining museum is up in Last Chance Basin, and normally we would be open right by now, but the trestle on Basin Road was damaged at a rock slide this wintertime, so we're hoping to open here in June.
Oh, okay.
And this is a great way to help support the projects that we've got going on.
Awesome. Now, Gary, the Gastineau Channel Historical Society members get a little bit of a discount. Are they, is that in the Last Chance Mining Museum? Are they coordinated together in an effort?
Yes. The Gastineau Channel Historical Society is kind of the umbrella organization.
Okay.
We've actually been around for many years. Started originally in 1956 and then kind of regenerated in 84. And we operate the mining museum and we own and operate Sentinel Island Lighthouse, amongst other things that we do in the community.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, because I know that there's always restoration things that need to happen for lighthouses. Is that part of what this money goes to as well?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yep. We've done 13 windows out at the lighthouse, which was a big project, busting through 10 inches of concrete.
Wow.
60 years old. Yes, it was quite the ordeal.
So we should mention that this is on June 10th. What is the day of the week?
It's Saturday.
It's a Saturday. Okay. So Saturday, June 10th is when this will be happening. The vessel will depart from Auk Bay at 1:30 and it returns, from Sentinel Island about 6 p.m. But when you get to the island, I'm assuming is when Renee's famous picnic happens.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
So
there'll be plenty to eat.
I'm hungry right now. So tell me, what am I going to be eating at this picnic?
Well, we're going to have barbecued ribs and a beautiful Cajun boil.
Whoa.
Of shrimp and corn on the cob and potatoes and all the fixings that go along with all that good stuff.
It sounds like a one of those perfect summer kind of picnics.
Yes.
Yeah, potato salad, all the things, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And what is your secret? Like in terms of like what makes it famous? Is there something you do in some of the
voodoo magic
that you make happen? Like how does that work? And do you make all this or do you have some help?
We have a nice crew that is going to go out the night before to help make sure everything's set up to do all the cooking and putting out and preparing everything to put out for the picnic.
I gotcha. Okay. And I know that this is a very limited seating kind of situation, right?
The boat only holds 40. So
the boat holds 40 people. So if you're interested in this for June 10th, and basically also we should mention that the cost of this, the proceeds are benefiting the Last Chance Mining Museum. So nobody's making a fortune off of this. It's more of a chance to get out to the island on hopefully a sunny day and see this.
Share some of our history.
Share some of the history. That's great. Now, I was looking, what is your website for the Gastineau Historical Society?
It's junohistory.org.
That's what I thought. And I saw on there a really cool thing where you have, you can look up any day of the year. And then there's definite like entries for different things that have happened throughout time that have to do with, you know, probably buildings being built and various things happening during the history of Juneau, right? How far back does it go?
Well, it goes back to the early 1800s, and it does talk about, you know, the indigenous people being here.
Yeah.
And then comes up from that. Of course, we don't have a lot of written history about that.
Yeah.
But it's the newest item that we have on our website. It's just been posted in the last, you know, 2 to 3 weeks. And one of our board members, Rich Madsen, has spent a couple of years researching and putting that all together. And the plan is that as time, people comment on it and submit more information, he would build on that. So
that's nice.
It's going to be pretty comprehensive. It already is. It's very detailed.
Yeah, it's pretty detailed in the different entries I looked at. And that's really cool that you are including, you know, Indigenous history as part of that, because I think that, you know, there's been a lot of things that have happened that aren't necessarily good. And we can also talk about those, right, in terms of what our history is and what it means. But the structures are here and this lighthouse is here, and lighthouses are cool.
Lighthouses are cool.
And do people get to go into the structure of the lighthouse at all?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. So you can go up. Is there like a spiral staircase and all that cool stuff?
Up at the top, there is a spiral staircase.
Yeah.
The rest of it is square.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Goes around.
That's pretty awesome. So this is the Sentinel Island Lighthouse Cruise and Keeper's Picnic. What does that mean, Keeper's Picnic?
Well, the lighthouse has always had lighthouse keepers. And when we took over the lighthouse 25 years ago, we just kind of made ourselves the keepers because we've been spearheading all the preservation for the Historic Society and getting volunteers and recruiting everything that needs to be done to make everything happen.
Oh, that's pretty cool. And so how do we get more information and or make a reservation for this?
You can call me at 907-780-4355. That's how you get on the list.
I love it. Old school.
Old school.
Forget this website stuff. Just call Renee and get on the list.
There you go.
Yeah, I'll make sure I put
my list because I'll be at the dock meeting you.
I'll make sure that I put the phone number on the website on the show notes for this page. And so, Renee and Gary, thank you so much for being here and telling us about the Sentinel Island Lighthouse Cruise and Keeper's Picnic. It sounds really awesome. It's June 10th. 2000. Well, yeah, I was going to say the year. It won't be next year. And it leaves from Auk Bay at 1:30 on that day. And you're going to call Renee at 907-780-4355 for more information.
Great.
Awesome. Gunnith Cheech for being here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, Treadwell Historic Trail has a new augmented reality tour. We'll talk about the tech and the tours with the creators of this new venture next. You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO. Here's a little Sounds Wild.
Sounds Wild. Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. On a crisp fall day, I'm deer hunting in the southeast rainforest with a friend. It's his first trip. I bring a .22 pistol in case I come across a dusky grouse. We call them hooters. And on this afternoon, I've bagged one of these tasty chicken-sized birds.
I show my friend how to field dress it, and as I open up the neck, we see the crop. It's the size of a golf ball, and it's full of blueberries, as fresh and clean as if we had picked them. The crop, also called a craw, is a temporary storage place, a specialized part of the esophagus of some birds. It's before the gizzard in the stomach, and it's just an expandable membranous sac, and it has no stomach acids. It's a holding place for food, for birds that tend to gorge themselves. Usually that's birds that eat seeds or berries, but vultures also have crops. Owls do not have crops, and most seabirds don't either. I cut this crop open and show my friend the warm blueberries, and then I eat them right there, mostly for the shock value. They are delicious, and he's appalled, which adds to my satisfaction. Honeybees also have a crop, which serves the same purpose as the bird's crop. The worker bee stores the nectar she collects from flowers in her crop without digesting it to transport it back to the hive. Sounds wild. I'm Riley Woodford.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Sometimes the news can be overwhelming. We could all use some help sorting out what's important. That's where The Signal comes in. It's KTOO's weekly email newsletter filled with the most interesting and important local and statewide stories that you need to know about. Get clarity on what's going on in your community and the rest of Alaska delivered right to your inbox by signing up for The Signal today. Visit ktoo.org/signal to subscribe.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon on KTOO, broadcasting live from the homelands of the Occoquan. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. A guided and spoken narrative tour in augmented reality is happening at Treadwell Historic Trail. Joining me to chat about it are Travis Smith and Aaron Murray, owners of this venture, which is called the Treadwell, Alaska's Lost Mine. Welcome to you both. Gonna teach for being here.
Thank you, Boston.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Boston.
And Travis, we know you as sort of a foodie about town, right?
That's right. Yeah, I've been doing restaurant and food things here in town for a little over 25 years now.
Holy moly. And I know that, what is it? The cornflake chocolate chip cookie is one of my favorites.
That's good to hear.
I think that's, I'm always sad when I go in and it's not there and I'm like, dang it, I missed out on that today. Oh, well, have to come back another day. So it's a pleasure to have you both here. Aaron's joining us via Zoom. So what is this tour? Let's start there. What is this tour?
Maybe I'll take that, Aaron.
Yeah, go for it.
I think so. For the most part, what we've developed is about an hour and a half walk-in tour where we can bring a group through the lower loop, talk about what was there, how the town of Treadwell opened and went up to the point where it had a tragic mine collapse and eventually closed. And we've developed an app that runs on iPads that allows us to kind of show people some of these things that were there, that if you're familiar with the area, you see a lot of broken buildings and parts of things littering the forest. And we've taken time to rebuild some of these things in the closest 3D approximation of what was there.
Right. So, Aaron, what is augmented reality? What does that mean?
Yeah, good, fair question, Boston. So people, you know, there's been a huge influx of terminology around augmented and virtual reality. In this sense, augmented reality, it utilizes the camera lens on the iPad essentially as a set of eyes, and then it adds a software layer on top of that to make it seem like there's more existing in the world in front of you than there actually is.
Ah, I see. I know that some people might be familiar with this technology because I think like there's certain websites, giant websites owned by billionaire tech people, where you can look at furniture and you can say like, oh, show us your room and here's what this piece of furniture will look like. Is it something like that?
That's a great example, except for we've expanded out to the scale of 500-foot-long wharfs and 200-feet-long steamships and fully operating machinery.
Wow. And so
I'm seeing that on. So is each person given an iPad? Is that how it works? And they're as they're going on the tour and they're watch, they're looking at what's really there, but then they look down at the iPad and they might see the ship or they might see a building in its full glory, that kind of thing. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm not having to wear like some sort of VR helmet.
No. I mean, there's, if we, on the hardware side of things, a lot of the headsets, as you mentioned, are a little bit awkward.
He wouldn't be able to walk on a trail, I don't think.
No. We definitely wouldn't feel safe with as many pieces of rusted out railroad tracker out there, having people wandering through there. But it's also in a software mixing with the hardware sense. The lenses that are in those headsets aren't really made for outdoor use yet. Hopefully they'll get there in coming time and maybe they'll also get a bit more comfortable along the way. But right now we felt that utilizing Apple's iOS system on the iPad gave people an opportunity to engage with the software and then choose to set it down while they're back on site and walking around, and so that they can really flip between the historic world and the known world as we see it now.
I see. So like Travis, basically the augmented reality and the way it's done now, it's sort of like maybe when I was a kid, I had on 3D glasses, right? And would change the view of things. That's kind of what this is, right? It's like looking at it from, it's sort of taking what's there, but adding something to it.
Yeah. The addition is, I think, the key part there, because we're not just changing the color of the trees, so to speak. We want to, in some of these areas, you know, show you what was there before the trees regrew.
Right.
You know, or in even really some areas, because so much of that area is built on the tailings and that was the result of the mine.
Right.
You know, some of these things just didn't exist prior to the trees. You know, it was some of these buildings were built on so close to the edge of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, but yeah, wow. I'm really proud with the team that in a really short period of time from, you know, January this year when the work began on it, the visuals on it are pretty fun. You know,
yeah.
We worked with the Treadwell Society and we accessed information and photos from within the archives themselves. And within the app, it allows people to also see what we've created and then flip to a gallery and kind of see how we built the models. They can see the photos that we used.
I see.
That were taken in the place where maybe they're standing.
Yeah.
That shows them the building that we've built that they can look around at.
Right. Yeah. So what kinds of features will we see on this tour? I know there's, you know, sort of a 500-foot sort of, we're going to see kind of a boat. We're going to see, what else are we going to see? Are we going to see like the Treadwell office? Are we going to see like what that would have looked like?
We didn't.
So
go ahead, Aaron.
So we did not model out the office building due to all of the really fantastic work that the Historical Society has already done in there. We did model out the general store, which was originally located right next to the office building.
Right.
And so when you all of the each individual AR story is attached to a GPS proximity sensor that the app recognizes you're at the location and then the story appears. And so people are allowed to shop, sort of go window shopping at a full size model of the general store. You can walk right up to the guys at the counter and read the newspaper and the cans on the back of the wall.
That's wild.
Another really fun one is we recreated, the entire crowd and all of the buildings, that were on site for the 1908 July 4th celebration, you know. Every Junoite knows that July 4th holds a special place for the summer, and being able to recreate the hose races of 1908, and you can take the iPad and walk through the crowd and sort of like be shoulder to shoulder with the models of all of these people as they stood, 115 years ago now.
Wow. And I know you're going to have some stories they're going to be able to follow. What are some of these stories? What are these about in terms of, are you following specific people and their journey through their life in the town, or what is that? What is that?
Not a specific person. That was something we considered when we were looking at how do we create a narrative around this?
Yeah.
More so we just take people through time
and
talk about the start of it, talk about information behind like the whens and the wheres of the tour, you know?
Yeah.
Why is it called Treadwell? Like who showed up there first?
And I see.
And it's a pretty good comprehensive tale that, you know, by the end of it, people can learn quite a bit about the history.
Is there audio to this?
No, we just have a guide.
Okay. I was curious because like the sounds of the machines that I've heard about, like there was so many, so loud, you could hear it all the way down the channel and things like that.
We considered that.
Yeah.
We let you walk through the Vanner room with all 300 rollers in peace. It's a silent experience. <Yeah. laughs> See all of the machinery working and you can explore it. But no, there's no sound associated with it. And that sort of cacophony that you referenced there, you know, we were also a little bit worried about that on site, about having, 10 to 12 iPads all sort of syncing up in a bunch of machinery, you know, it would be really difficult to line up any sort of a spoken audio track. But like Travis mentioned, we hired a content research team and they came up with this really compelling narrative that starts in 1880, with the discovery of gold over in the Silver Bow Basin. And then it ends, in the roughly year after the cave-in of 17. We start at the five stamp mill and sort of familiarize people with how to use the application. And we take them all the way through the Treadwell Express train, all of the machinery, all the buildings, all the way right up to the cave-in site and show a model of the cave-in and then bring it back to sort of show that the waterfront of Juneau has sort of been continually evolving ever since then. And that's the final step in the tour.
Right. Okay, cool. And I know that you mentioned to me that you have a land acknowledgement for this to at least recognize, the people that were on the land, for time immemorial, because Treadwell was sort of a colonial kind of a thing, right? But you're sort of focusing the tour on the technology, the buildings, the ships, kind of the area itself. Right, in terms of the history of that area for this particular time period.
Yeah, and that's something that we talked about for a while. Like, how can we best approach that? It is a sensitive subject on a sensitive piece of land, and some people we talk to, you know, say the land itself had some different claims to really, like, who came to that site specifically to use it the most. Our focus on it was to, you know, we kind of acknowledge the fact that we are here and we try to point people into town at the end of the tour to come into the town and see what is so vibrant now.
Yeah.
For us, it's a big point that this was something that came, that happened and is gone.
Right.
And now we get to enjoy the nature that has come up through it.
Yeah.
Talk about what was there. I think talking about the colonial aspect of it is something that I wasn't sure how to approach in some ways.
Yeah.
Like that isn't not my personal story.
Right.
And while we wanted to be able to like frame what we're doing there, like clearly just talking about something that happened and that the majority of this information, you know, you could go spend a week in the museum and get all of it or, you know, go like a lot of the informational signs that Treadwell has built was kind of our basis for thoughts. I'm like, how can we work to present this in a different format kind of bridges the technological aspect.
Absolutely. And maybe as the tour progresses or gets deeper, maybe expand the tour, maybe there'll be some other knowledge there, bring in a partner, somebody who knows some of that kind of history and maybe be able to add, because I think that would be interesting in terms of like, especially for, I'm assuming this is sort of targeted towards tourists a little bit, but also locals who may not know the history there. Right. And so that's kind of a well-rounded history to have all aspects of it, which would be kind of cool. But I think looking at it from the sense of the buildings and the technology and what was there, and like you said, just sort of capturing this space and time of this, what was sort of a boom, right? And then a bust, really, with the cave-in. That is a fascinating piece of history in and of itself. So how do we find out more? How do we get information on getting on the tour? And when does it start? And how long is it going for?
Sure, yeah. Well, we've got a website. You could go right now to treadwelltour.com. We've got a schedule of tours that you could book immediately through there now. And they'll probably be more added through the summer as we kind of line out more of our availability. We have spoken with a few of the school groups and hope to be able to reach out to larger groups in the fall, kind of as they're coming back to school. But we'd love to be able to bring some groups of people through this. We've got an introductory rate going right now.
Awesome.
For the tour, $89 a person. It's kind of, you know, we provide all of the equipment for everybody. If we have a large enough group, we could look at maybe doing some transportation on that if needed. The transportation that we're currently providing is just kind of picking up the people that we're booking the tours with through the tour and through the cruise ships. But that's something we could probably arrange as well.
That's cool. So you go to treadwelltour.com, find out some information or contact if you have something specific going on or a specific group that you want to do. I think the tech is really amazing and kind of cool. And I'm really excited to see how that grows. And like you can maybe add more features, right, in terms of other places that might have been there or other parts of town. Like if it's something that is interesting, because I'm sure it takes a lot of work to model all this stuff and to put it all together in the app. And what a great venture. I'm so excited for y'all, and I hope that it booms and doesn't bust this summer.
Right. Yeah,
so,
thanks.
Aaron and Travis, thank you for joining me today. Gonna the cheese on the venture, and hope all goes well. You can go to treadwelltour.com for more information on the augmented tour of the Treadwell Historic Trail.
Thank you, Boston.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Boston. We appreciate it.
The Juno Library up next has some updates, including an author event with Zeta Elliott. This is KTOO, and you are listening to a Juno Afternoon. Here's a little bird note.
This is Bird Note. Climate change poses a big threat to all life on Earth, and birds are no exception. Gary George is the director of the Clean Energy Initiative for the National Audubon Society, and he says that wind turbines are essential to meet our carbon reduction goals. But there is a catch.
Turbines do kill birds. Birds can fly into them. Those blades are spinning really fast, but there are ways to avoid that, to minimize that.
Gary and his team at Audubon provide guidance on how to make wind farms safer for birds.
The first best way is to not put them in places where there's lots of birds.
For wind farms that are already built, new technologies that detect birds and temporarily shut off turbines as they pass through could help protect big species such as eagles and condors that are at high risk of collisions.
We're pushing it to be tested for whooping cranes, for instance, and for other species of large-bodied birds, and we hope at some point it'll even be able to detect smaller bodied birds. So for us, it's a very exciting technology. So at this point, you know, there's a lot of things that project developers can do to protect birds.
Learn more about how to make energy projects safer for birds on the Bring Birds Back podcast. Listen to your favorite podcast app or at birdnote.org. I'm Tanaji Hamilton.
You're listening to Community Support at Juno Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juno and 91.7 Juno Lock Bay, online at KTOO.org. I'm Boston Christopher. Margaret Lukey, Grants and Marketing Coordinator from the Juno Public Library, is here with some special guests. MJ Grandy, Youth Services Librarian, and author Zeta Elliott joining us via Zoom. Hello to you all. How are you today?
Great to be here with you. Thanks, Boston. And Zeta, I cannot begin to tell you how excited we are to have you come.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. It's actually quite chilly here in Chicago today, so I think I'll be prepared by the time I arrive in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so that when is this event happening? I want to get right to that because I don't want to run out of time today. So Zeta is going to be here for an author event, and tell us when and where and all that good stuff.
So the event will be at the Valley Library on Tuesday, June 6th at 6:30 p.m. And then she's also going to be visiting two schools while she's here. So, but the public event will be at 6:30, and we're thrilled to have her. Hearthside will be there and are bringing some of her books and materials. So they will be available also.
Awesome. So anybody can come to this event, right?
This is welcome for everybody.
Yeah.
One of the wonderful things about Zeta is she writes for all ages and instructional materials. So she's a poet, but I'm going to be quiet so Zeta can talk about herself.
That's okay. Yeah, Zeta, I was looking at your website and wow, you do it all. You do plays, you do essays, you write books for youth, you write books for adults, you write so many ways. And I'm really curious about that. So it's like your website's a wonder to behold and you write in so many forms. What drives you in the work? What drives you to the work?
Oh my goodness. I think probably because I grew up with two parents who were teachers. So reading was a big part of my life. I loved to read. I'm Canadian. You'll probably hear my accent as I'm talking. But I grew up outside of Toronto, never seeing myself in books, really. So when I became an adult, when I went to graduate school, I started to understand the impact of what it does to a child when they feel as if they're invisible or erased from the books that they love. And I am healing from that process still as an adult. And I find writing is really therapeutic. So I have worked with kids for 30 years. I was a college professor for 10 years. I had students who hated to read, like my father. My father, who grew up in the Caribbean, hated to read because his grandmother used to make him stay inside and read Alice in Wonderland. And he loathed that book. He hated it. But I thought, you know, what if he'd have the books I had written? What if he'd had a book with a little black boy having magical adventures? You know, maybe I could get more people hooked on reading and they could realize just what an empowering and incredible activity it really is.
That's awesome. I'm going to see how I can ask this question, but does a certain shape to a story dictate which form you might choose? Like as an idea comes to you, do you say, okay, this is a novel or this is a play or this is for youth? Like how does that work in your brain?
Yeah, I would say writing for me is 70% dreaming. So I spend a lot of time before I sit down to actually type anything, really sitting with my characters, listening to them, hearing their voices, hearing their conflicts. And so by the time I have a sense of who my characters are and if they have a problem, what that problem might be, who they need to help them solve that problem, then I pretty much have a clear sense of whether or not it's going to be a play or a novel or a picture book. Increasingly, I'm writing hybrid forms. So I'm working on a time travel novel right now, which is also a hybrid novel in verse. So half of it is in prose and half of it will be in poems. I really try to think of as many entry points as possible for readers. So if you're someone who's a reluctant reader and you struggle with seeing a lot of text on the page, then let me make sure that it's fast-paced. Maybe it can be illustrated. If you include some poems, that could draw in some different kinds of readers. I think the genre, the shape of the story really comes once I hear the voices of my characters.
I see. Okay. And you mentioned the illustrations, and that's something I was fascinated by. You have a great page where there's, you know, all the different book covers and you can see. And I was like, at first I was like, oh, it looks, some of them look similar. But then I was noticing, I was like, there's different illustrators for so many of the different books. How do you decide on an illustrator?
Oh, great question. Well, that's something I'll be talking about when I give my presentation at the Juno Public Library. So I have published 42 books for young readers, and 2/3 of those I have had to self-publish. Most people probably know it's very difficult to get published by like Random House or Simon & Schuster. I've done about a dozen books with traditional publishers, but mostly I have made the books myself. I am not a good enough artist to do my own illustrations. And so I use websites like freelancer.com or upwork.com. And then you have access to illustrators all around the world. Just this morning, I was sending art notes to my illustrator in Inverness because I'm doing a picture book about a little boy who was unfortunately trafficked into Scotland in the 1700s. And I found an illustrator and she's doing an excellent job. So sometimes I give people a brief and I say, I want someone who can draw in the style of Ezra Jack Keats, who did The Snowy Day. But, you know, folks all around the world don't necessarily know his work. So I provide lots of examples. I try to provide as much art direction as I can.
Right. You could just point them to your website, which is ZettaElliott.com, by the way. and say, look at all these wonderful illustrations that I've already had done for myself.
You can't make it look like anything I've already done, but
in this vein, but make it different.
Standard.
The same, but totally different.
That's exactly it.
So what is your talk that's going to be happening here in Juneau? What is that going to be focused on? You mentioned that you were going to talk a little bit about illustration, but what else are you going to be talking about?
Yeah, my talk is titled Love and Resistance, Publishing for the People from the Heart. And, you know, a lot of our conversations around publishing end up being about how to make money and how much do you earn and your royalties and your advances and did you get a six-figure deal? And, you know, many of us come from communities, certainly in Alaska, many of us come from communities where storytelling served a different purpose. You know, it wasn't about making money. It was about passing on lessons and sharing values and bringing people closer together. And so my message to kids and to families, anybody who's interested, everyone has a story to tell, is that there is always a way to get your story to circulate, to get it in book form into the hands of kids where it can heal and empower and enrich their lives. Nobody has to wait for anyone else's approval to get their story out into the world. We have that power in our hands right now.
Wow. That sounds like it's going to be an amazing talk. Zetta, you are an inspiration in just the 10 minutes that I've been talking to you. Thank you so much. And Margaret, this is part of the library's summer reading program. Is that right? So there's other things that are going to be coming up throughout the summer and we'd want to be looking at the website, right?
Yes, it sure is. There's stuff coming down the pike for adults and children. Lots to talk about there.
Yeah. Yeah. So where do we go to find out all the information?
Sure. Our website, juno.org/library. From there, you can find under programs, you'll find summer reading.
Summer reading. Okay. And MJ, you've been doing a lot of coordination of some of these youth programs, right? For the summer reading program?
Event. I want to do a shout out to every parent out there of a child in either elementary school or middle school. We've been visiting the schools and every child has been given a flyer to take home. So ask your child for the summer reading program flyer from the library and you'll have a lot of information in your hands.
I love that. Hey, kid, where's that flyer that I know you have that you got from your school so we can get you some reading this summer? That's very, very important. Margaret MJ Zetta, thank you so much for being here and telling us about this awesome event. It's happening at the Valley Library, 6:30 p.m. on June 6th. So you want to make sure you head over there and meet Zetta and all the wonderful things that she's going to be talking about. Her website is Zetta, Z-E-T-T-A, Elliot, E-L-L-I-O-T-T.com. And make sure you check out her website. It's pretty awesome. And juno.org/library for all the other information. Gwyneth Cheech, for you all being here today and giving us a little tiny preview of what this event is going to be. Thanks all.
Thank you.
That will do it for today's Juno Afternoon. Have a wonderful Wednesday. As a reminder, Juno Afternoon will be on break from tomorrow, Thursday, May 25th through Tuesday, June 6th. If you're looking to get on the program in June, email junoafternoon@kto.org and we will get back to you in early June when we return. Gwyneth Cheech for your continued support of Juno Afternoon. We normally air Tuesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juno 104.3 and KAUK Juno Auk Bay 91.7. Hello out the road. And the show is online at KTO.org/JunoAfternoon. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program. The Juno Afternoon is a project of the KTOO Arts and Culture team with help today from Juno Trip. Have a wonderful day.